Well, thank you, Bob, and thank you to all the organizers for giving me this opportunity to talk. And hopefully, between Bob's introduction and some of the specific details and projects that the four of us are going to discuss, hopefully you come away with a better idea of what we're actually doing when we talk about genome editing or gene editing and how we can use it to create new traits and produce better crops. Skip through the animations because they kind of annoy me, sorry. I'm sure everyone has seen a slide like this in pretty much every talk you've ever attended when you talk about agriculture and agronomy and plant genetics, but there's more people in the world. There are going to be more people in the world in 5, 10, 50 years than there are today, and we need to produce more food on less land with less inputs. But one thing that's also potentially overlooked in that aspect is not just making more food, we need to make healthier, higher quality food. And so that means sometimes going in and taking an existing crop plant or existing existing food product from a crop plant and making it better. And we can do that very same thing by employing some of the genome editing technologies that Bob talked about. Slide looks very familiar. As Bob mentioned, I'm going to focus mostly on TALEN. Our company specifically has IP that relates to TALEN and also meganucleases or homing endonucleases. We more or less don't use meganucleases anymore. Our company was founded based on IP license from the Institut Pasteur in Paris for meganucleases, and they spent a lot of time getting really good at engineering them, and just when they figured it out, TALENs came out. So we don't really talk about these, but they are a useful platform. They're just a little bit obsolete these days. And so, again, I'm just going to show a breeze through the slide, a kind of a different way to show what Bob already talked about. But essentially, you have a TALEN, a TAL-like effector nuclease. We have each one of these binding domains we can engineer to specifically allow them to recognize a certain sequence of DNA. And we can do that, and the other speakers will talk about it, I'm sure, to almost any sequence in the plant genome. So the whole idea is to create this customizable DNA scissors that allows us to create this double strand break at a locus or gene of interest. And what we do with that break, or rather what we hope the cell will do with that break, kind of depends on our product development or trait development outcome, or objective, sorry. So we can induce targeted mutagenesis, where simply we are either removing a few base pairs or even adding a few base pairs that are going to disrupt the function of a gene. You can also imagine doing this either in a expression-related sort of promoter or even a terminator sequence where you can actually modify the expression where you don't necessarily want to remove the function of the gene. The other pathway, using homologous recombination, which I'm not really going to talk about today, as Bob indicates, said earlier, that uses a donor matrix that uses homology arms that flank your target site deletion to then kind of allow the cell to use your template for repair as opposed to using the homologous chromosome for repair, which will ultimately result in no changes in your site that was broken. So now I want to focus a little bit more on some of the products and some of the traits we're developing. Our company is based just about 15 minutes north of here in New Brighton, and we focus on four key crops, soybean, potato, wheat, and canola. I'm going to talk about the two most advanced, which is our high oleic soybean. There's that buzzing again. The high oleic soybean and the improved quality potato. I stand over here. Can we turn one of these off?
I'm not sure if it's from there, if it's from this thing.
Don't move, Bob. I'm just kidding. I'll stay here. Maybe it's me moving around that's doing it. Okay. Our improved quality potato, and then I'm going to briefly talk about our project in wheat. I'm not really going to focus on canola. I think Jim is going to talk a little bit more about their canola platform. Oh, I moved. So first is the healthier soybean oil. As some of you may or may not be aware, the FDA recently issued, I think, a 3-year window in which food companies have to completely remove trans fats from any foods for sale in the United States. The writing's been on the wall for a number of years, and food companies, not only in response to this anticipated ban, but also the desire of consumers to have less trans fats in their diets. Food companies have been slowly removing trans fats from some of their food products, but you'd be surprised how many trans fat-containing food products are still out there. And so one way we can go about that, especially in the U.S., is reducing the amount of trans fat that Americans get in their diet from soybean oil. As many of you are aware, more aware than I am, I'm sure, soybean is a very important rotation crop here in the U.S. For corn, especially here in the Midwest and the Corn Belt states. And so we needed to find a way to improve the oil that's created from this, the approximately 80 million acres of soybean that's grown in the U.S. And so here I'm just showing a comparison of some of the common dietary fats or vegetable fats, although a few animal-related fats in the bottom. You can see soybean, soybean is about 54% linoleic acid and only about 23% oleic acid. Oleic acid, when it's in higher constituent, being a monounsaturated fat, is not only healthier, but it also is better for improved shelf life and longer processing time. So places that use it when they to fry or bake with, when they can use it longer, they're not throwing out that oil. And so soybean, because it is high in linoleic, in order to bring about those improved heat processing and storage characteristics that food companies want, soybean oil was hydrogenated. That resulted in a lot of trans fats. So our objective was to remove this linoleic or severely reduce the linoleic component and replace it with oleic acid, therefore not really necessarily requiring the hydrogenation that resulted in the trans fats. So I'll come back to this slide in just a few minutes, but you can see the variation in the amounts of dietary fats commonly consumed. Okay, so one of the key things that we wanted to do was minimize the amount of linoleic acid. And so through work not done by us, but just research done over the years in soybean, we determined that the one gene or two genes specifically, the fatty acid desaturase genes, were responsible for the conversion of oleic acid precursors into linoleic. So very simplistically, we thought if we can, and it wasn't our idea to knock this gene out, it's been already done, but we wanted to do it in a way that was non-transgenic and didn't involve either large random mutations generated by things such as EMS, fast neutrons, etc. We wanted to do it in a very targeted way. So by removing these fatty acid desaturase genes, we were hoping to shift the fatty acid profile from canonical soybean to something more like olive oil, where you have a high percentage of oleic, which is actually kind of drawn out in our line there. And so the workflow that we use, and this is very similar to what Bob talked about, I just kind of show it in a very specific for the two genes we're talking about. We were able to design one single TALEN that targeted both the FAD21A and FAD21B genes of soybean. We use sequence homology just to identify a region very early on in the open reading frame of these FAD21A and 1B genes, where a TALEN would recognize, create a double-strand break, and hopefully create mutations in both of these genes. As Bob indicated, we started with soybean half-seed explants and went through a standard transformation procedure where we just inserted a TALEN expression cassette into soybean. It went through very typical tissue culture techniques and created a T0 plant through very standard techniques using selectable markers to identify individual plants that had our transgene. We were then able to also screen these individual plants to identify any that had mutations at our genes of interest. As Bob indicated, we just self those individuals in soybean, which is very easy, and had a number of T1 populations that had not only the transgene segregated away, but also had a number of different phenotypes for the FAD21A and 1B genes. What was so useful about this sort of technique is it allows us to go into a plant like soybean and create a transgenic plant, which the protocol is very easy, very known, and then regenerate a number of individuals that allowed us to really kind of fine-tune the phenotype we wanted. Literature suggested you had to knock out both genes to create your gene of interest, but you can imagine sometimes maybe the homozygous FAD2B and heterozygous A might have actually given us the phenotype we wanted. So we create this allelic series of plants after we do this segregation event. It turns out in the case of soybean, we wanted to remove both FAD21A and 1B, but in other crops, creating that allelic series is actually very useful. And so We created a number of transgenic plants, and I don't want to say we got lucky, but in the first 10 plants that we screened, in our first 10 transgenic plants we screened, we found three with mutations, one that specifically had a mutation in FAD2-1A and 1B. We simply selfed that plant, identified the double homozygous null segregants, and grew those seeds up and had the fatty acid profile analyzed. And much as we expected, the oleic acid concentration of our double homozygous plants went from about the 20% you see in canonical soybean upwards of 80 or even greater. We saw a severe reduction in the linoleic acid as well as linolenic to the in the realm of 3 to 4%. And we also saw about a 15 to 20% drop in the saturated fats, so the palmitic and stearic. So as I said, we created a number of transgenic events. We so happened to find the one in our very first screen that had the mutations we were interested in, but we created a number of mutations of various sizes and lengths in the FAD2 and 1A and 1B genes. So now this new soybean that we created has a fatty acid profile very similar to olive oil and also very similar to some of the high oleic canola oils and high oleic sunflower oils you're seeing more and more on the market as consumers and the food industry are both trying to develop these high oleic varieties of crop plants to produce oils that have a higher heat stability and longer shelf life. And so our soybean, again, doesn't require hydrogenation, so there's no production of trans fats, and it meets some of those quality criteria that the food processing and food companies want to see in an oil like this. And so one of the first questions we get regarding our this particular product or any trait we develop is, does that gene mutation create some sort of yield drag? In this particular case, we've grown these now three seasons, two in the U.S. and one in Argentina, and we see no difference in not only yield of grain, but also in the health or disease resistance of the plants. One might think that if you start knocking out fatty acid biosynthesis genes, you could disrupt certain other necessary plant functions. We tested the fatty acid profile in leaves of our plants and saw no difference between our leaves of the FAD2-1A and 1B mutants and wild type. We didn't see any sort of changes in plant structure. We didn't see any other disease or insect pressures that weren't in the wild type. So in this particular case, the knockouts that we made changed nothing except the fatty acid profile. Okay, now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about potato. And the significant difference, I'd say, with potato compared to the soybean project was the manner in which we introduced our nuclease. Every plant you work in has its own nuances and difficulties when it comes to tissue culture-related applications and even molecular considerations you have to take into account for complex genomes. So one of the biggest problems with potato is people want French fries and chips all year, but we only harvest potatoes from about July or August till about now. So a majority of the potatoes that are processed in the U.S., specifically for processed food products such as chips, fries, hash browns, you name it, are stored cold and then brought out of storage and taken to the processing plant. One problem with this is a phenomenon known as cold-induced sweetening. So when you store potatoes in the cold, is why your grandmother probably never put potatoes in the fridge, when you store potatoes cold and then heat process them, you get a very dark, unappealing product, and you can actually produce a neurotoxin, acrylamide, as a result of these reducing sugars combining with some free amino acids when the temperature is above 250 degrees. So one of the things we looked to do was severely knock back or remove the production of these cold-induced sweetening reducing sugars. So if you've never seen a potato storage facility, it is amazing. Picture a building about the size of a basketball arena that's just full three stories with potatoes. It's unbelievable. But one of the problems in storing potatoes this way is the need to store them cold so they don't rot, because they are a perishable food item. And we want to remove this conversion, the sucrose to glucose, sucrose to glucose and fructose. And as a result of this process, anywhere from 5 to up to 15% of the potato crop, it can't be used for a particular food product that it was intended. So you might be growing russet Burbanks for McDonald's French fries, But if they undergo this process, those potatoes can no longer be produced into fries and are produced into a lower value crop, or I'm sorry, product. So similar to the soybean project, we look to simply remove the gene that's responsible for this conversion of sucrose to glucose and fructose. That gene is known as the vacuole invertase. I'm just going to abbreviate it here as VIMV. So very similar setup to our soybean project. The only key difference, as you'll see, is we started with potato protoplast instead of actually making a transgenic plant. We did that here because potato and other solanaceous crops are just much more amenable to manipulation in a protoplast and then allowing to go from a single cell through a callus and all the way up into a full plant. But the principle is nearly the same. We identify a region of homology in all four alleles of the vacuole invertase gene, potato being a complex tetraploid. There is significant variation between these four alleles, so it was a little bit cumbersome to identify a talon that recognized all four targets. We went through very standard tissue culture techniques. We're able to generate callus and ultimately plants that had had gone through this, had seen the vacuole invertase nuclease and gone through this plant regeneration procedure. The big difference here, though, however, is we didn't select. We didn't generate an individual plant that we knew had our nuclease. We had no idea which plants that came out of this actually had the nuclease in that cell that created double-strand break and ultimately a deletion. So we had to screen approximately 600 plants, which isn't that large of a number, but compared to the 10 for soybean, it was a little more cumbersome. And we were able to identify, again, an allelic series of plants that had either one, two, three, or all four alleles of the vacuole invertase gene knocked out. Specifically, since we wanted to create a product that would have to go to the field, we wanted to also verify that these were transgene-free. So even though we didn't introduce the nuclease expression cassette with the intention of it integrating, it does integrate at some frequency. So we were able to identify 18 individual plants that had some level of deletion at vacuole invertase, but were also transgene-free. And so we were able to produce small tubers from some of these plants, and we then tested them against wild-type plants that were both cold-stored, non-cold-stored, and then also our variety that was cold-stored but had the various knockouts at vacuole invertase. So you can see here a chip that looked like this, stored at 4 degrees, which is much colder than they stored anyway. We were just trying to really see how robust our phenotype was. 2 weeks cold storage of normal Ranger russet potatoes at 4 degrees, and those are the chips you get. Not very appealing at all. You can see the wild-type chips are the type that you'd expect to see in a bag of Frito-Lay or other brands of chips. And our knockout, very similar to the wild-type. We measured the reducing sugars, and as you can see in our wild-type plants, a large amount of sucrose, but relative to our four-allele, I'm sorry, I'm looking at that dark blue or purple is our four-allele knockout, so a large amount of sucrose relative to the fructose and glucose. So we interrupted that cold-induced sweetening conversion. Just as importantly, we wanted to look at how these chips created from both our 4-degree cold-stored wild-type line here and 4-degree cold-stored knockout line had in levels of acrylamide production, and we had almost a 3- to 4-fold decrease in the amount of acrylamide in our knockout potatoes versus wild-type. So the second question I get asked most often is, what is the regulatory considerations for these types of products? And so the USDA has a process by which you can ask if a product you've created or a product you are going to create is considered a non-regulated article. And so we asked USDA that very same question about our vacuole invertase potato, as well as our FAD2 soybean, and in both instances they indicated that these were non-regulated articles. So that means we can take these plants out to the field and do field trials, conduct breeding, and do all the sorts of things you would want to do in order to develop a product to go to market, without the regulatory regulated field trials and the deregulation process. How am I doing on time? And so now I want to talk just a little bit about kind of where we're not so much shifting focus, but I guess kind of taking on a much more complex crop and a much more complex gene target, and that is going after gluten reduction in wheat. And I could probably spend an hour talking about gluten reduction and how complex not only that target is, but how complex the wheat genome is. I'm just going to give a very 10,000-foot view about what we're trying to accomplish here and how we're going to use our gene editing technology to hopefully reduce or improve the quality of wheat as it relates to gluten. And so I'm sure many of you are aware there are a number of gluten-related disorders, not only gluten in wheat, but any sort of cereal grain that produces gluten. You might be familiar with the celiac disease. It only affects about 1 to 2% of the population. So in that particular case, any level of gluten can have very bad side effects. But there are a bunch of other sort of gluten-related disorders, gluten sensitivity, specific wheat allergies, gluten ataxia. All these are results of certain components of the gluten that interacts in a negative way with our digestive systems. And so one of the problems associated with gluten is not all of the population actually is diagnosed with a particular form of either celiac disease or gluten sensitivity. Some of you may have these symptoms and just attribute it to that very greasy cheeseburger you just ate or something else, when it could be a result of gluten sensitivity. And especially if you are celiac, the only cure so far is to have a gluten-free diet. And if anyone has had to try to remove gluten from your diet, you can understand and appreciate how difficult that is in the modern world. And so one of the things we wanted to do was try to remove the components of gluten that elicited this response. And again, I could get into a lot more about the gluten biochemistry and how it interacts, but I don't want to kind of go down that path today. I just want to briefly talk about how we're specifically going to try to address this. And so with wheat specifically, we have to target all copies, at least in the platform that we're undertaking right now. We want to target all three copies, all six alleles of a particular target gene. In the case of gluten, there are a number of genes, so the complexity of our project is increasing pretty significantly. For wheat, we're going to try a number of different transformation technologies, both the standard integration of a TALEN expression cassette, but we're also going to try to work with wheat protoplast to get our TALEN into the wheat genome and elicit the response. One of the specific things we're going to try to do, and as Bob mentioned it earlier, is we either A, are going to try to clip out entire regions of the wheat genome. Gluten genes tend to be exist in tandem, so we're going to try removing whole chunks of the chromosome to remove a number of gluten expression genes. Or we're going to specifically try to remove small parts of a gluten gene that still allows it to have the quality characteristics that the milling companies want to see, but no longer have that epitope that elicits this immune response. Go through the very typical tissue culture, calciformation, and plant regeneration, and hopefully identify plants that have improved gluten. And don't even want to say reduce gluten. We just want to say improve gluten. The gluten is very important. Without it, you don't get bread to rise. You don't get pasta to have that consistency you want. So we want to very much go in and edit the gluten in plants so that they still have all the characteristics that you want to see in some of the food products you're used to eating, but don't give you that that response, that immune response and sensitivity. And so I just want to follow up with the last two slides here to kind of summarize the difference between what we at Calyx do and what is typically done when it comes to the development of traits through a traditional GM or genetic engineering or GMO process. So the process at the bottom is kind of a generalized or average process that takes into account a number of different crop types and a number of different trait targets or objectives. But in general, the trait development process can take about 13 years and cost upwards of $130 million. It can be shorter and cheaper in other crops, but a lot of times companies like Monsanto and Pioneer and Syngenta have spent a lot of money and a lot of time developing some of these traits that they've developed. Using our technology, and some of the gene editing types of protocols that we've developed, we can very much streamline and shorten the amount of time and the amount of cost it takes to bring a trait to market. And so what I'm showing here is, again, generalized for a number of different crops that we work in, indicating that we could bring something to market as quick as 6 years. Again, depending on the crop, it might be a little longer. But we are completely removing not only the construct optimization and commercial event development, but also a lot of the regulatory requirements that companies need to go through in order to deregulate a crop and allow it to be grown on wide acreage. So in summary, we use Talon to efficiently engineer crop genomes. I didn't really speak a lot about the efficiency levels of percentage of mutagenesis, things of that nature. I wanted to focus really more on how we've used these technologies, or specifically the Talon technology, to create in a very short timeline two products that we're very optimistic about and very much looking forward to bringing to market. We're looking to establish a very robust pipeline. As you can sit here now, I'm sure each of you could probably think of 10, 20, 30 targets that you would find interesting to knock out, not only in a research setting, but also in a product development setting. So we're looking to fill our pipeline with a number of these sorts of targets and traits. I showed you the one regulatory letter from the U.S. Granted, there's a lot of other places in the world that are not only do our agricultural products, but the food that we create gets exported. And so there are a number of countries that are making or will be making a number of similar opinions. This technology is so new that these sorts of questions are just now being asked of these regulators. And lastly, because of this non-regulated status, we've been able to take our high oleic soybean and our improved cold storability potato out to the field and are able to assess their not only their agronomic characteristics, but also the trait that we were trying to create. And with that, I'll take any questions. So right now, basically, our plan is we follow the rules at which they're written right now, and if those rules change, we will change with them. We are engaging consumer groups very preliminary stages at the moment because we're several years away from commercializing, right? But right now, we're working with some of these groups to make them aware of our technology and how very much different they are than traditional GM techniques, but also how similar they are to conventional plant breeding, i.e. looking for natural variation within a population of either wild type accessions or just a germplasm pool in general, how we're doing something very similar to that. We're just doing it in a very targeted way in elite material to quicken the time that it takes to develop a product and minimize the amount of breeding. So we're just kind of going down that path, but yeah, you're right, engaging the public is going to be important. And being transparent. I think that was kind of the problems with some of the early transgenic products that came to market, and we just want to be as transparent about what we're doing as possible. So I'm very much not a patent lawyer, and our legal team would probably just want me to say no comment at that question. But what I can say is you can't necessarily patent a gene, right? So you can't therefore patent a gene knockout per se. We can protect the specific edits that we made, but we can't stop someone else from making a similar edit in the same gene. Does that make sense? We also have protection around the methodologies we use, so Talon and meganucleases, so that affords us some protection, but at the end of the day, you can't patent a gene.
I think we have maybe time for one more question tonight.
So the most important prerequisite is using the gene for the tech before using this technology, correct?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
You need to know the gene for the tech.
Yeah, you need to know your gene, not only your gene target, but your gene sequence. Which is getting easier and easier these days with the amounts of number of crop plants that had their whole genome sequenced. One thing that's useful, even if you don't know the specific gene target in your particular crop, a lot of times there's relatives or even completely unrelated crops that address a very similar issue that you can then use to identify your potential gene target in your crop and go in and do some targeted sequencing and try to bring about a similar phenotype. We've seen it in herbicide tolerance. You know, some of the genes that are responsible for herbicide sensitivity to glyphosate and others, those genes are conserved across a number of crops. Virus resistance is another one. If you see a virus that has a very similar mode of action in one particular plant, let's say in corn, but you want to work in cucumber, if that crop, or I'm sorry, if that, that interaction is very similar, you could probably find the gene in melon, or cucumber, sorry, that is similar to the maize one and hopefully go in and change it. So you do need to know the target, though, yeah.
All right, thanks, BJ.